The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
You know, in Bush v. Gore, the Supreme Court said that actually individuals don't have any entitlement to vote individually for a presidential candidate until the state legislature gives it to them. In this case, North Carolina has given it to them, but has done so contingent on these other dispute resolution procedures going to the General Assembly and to the governor. So you could see maybe an argument having more sway there to say, well, these rules are a little bit in advance. Other states that haven't done that, though, they do have to overcome those questions, not only of the safe harbor requirements, but also of potential constitutional questions about the ability to take away the right to vote for president once it's been given to the population of their states.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 7th, 2020. We've got an election in less than a month, and lots of analysts seem to be expecting contested results. Doomsday scenarios are playing out in the pages of national magazines. The campaigns are geared up for legal challenges, and a lot of people are super worried about it. But there's something missing from a lot of these conversations. Actual state law. State laws are the rules under which an election will initially be challenged, and they differ a great deal from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Scott Anderson led a team for Lawfare that surveyed the key battleground states' challenge regimes for contested elections. How do they differ? How are they similar? Which ones give rise to particular concerns? And what does it all mean for the federal election coming up? It's the Lawfare Podcast, October 7th, Scott Anderson on state election rules. Before we get started, Scott, I just want to alert listeners to noises that may be showing up in today's podcast. Today in the virtual jungle studio, we have a lot of birds. On my end and on your end, we have a whole lot of construction equipment. Just bear with us if you hear squawking or roaring or, you know, beeping backup noises from trucks. It's all part of podcasting in the COVID era. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Scott, tell us a little bit about this project. Get us started. How did you come to be surveying the election laws of a bunch of states, and how did you choose which states to look at?
Absolutely. Well, the whole idea really came out of my effort to begin to digest and understand a little bit about what the legal procedures are going to look like in the event that there is a dispute regarding the results of the election, kind of after the fact. We're seeing a lot of litigation right now about what rules will govern the election, kind of the ex ante beforehand, but there's going to be a lot of disputes, or at least the potential for disputes after the fact, and including related litigation. Turns out it's a pretty complex layer of both federal rules, but most importantly, state rules that are put in place here. Since the 1880s, federal law has really made it the first responsibility of the states to resolve their own disputes regarding presidential elections, and in some cases also congressional elections, which we can get into as well. It's a little more complicated there. That is kind of based on the logic that the Constitution makes it up to the state legislatures to determine how the electoral votes are going to be allocated for each state. And therefore, beginning in the 1880s, after a very contentious 1876 presidential election that was resulted in a fairly uncomfortable compromise for a lot of people involved, and so fairly controversial, led them to try and adopt these set of procedures through what's called the Electoral Counts Act that kicks the question first to the states, gives them a period of time in which they can use their own procedures to resolve electoral disputes, and then in theory puts up a process by which Congress looks to those state results in deciding how it's going to count the electoral votes. Although, as we can discuss, there are some questions about how binding that process is. But because of that, we realize we really, to get an understanding of how electoral disputes are going to be resolved, the first place to start was with the states. And we decided to look at those 15 states that the Cook's political report identifies as being either toss-up states, lean Republican, or lean Democrat states, on the logic that those are the states that are likely to have the closest election, and therefore they're the ones that are most likely to have the results brought into question by a dispute over a certain number of ballots being compromised, something like that, that could have the most likelihood of actually impacting the results in those states for the presidential election. We also looked at procedures regarding the contest for congressional elections, because later in the process, after the state resolution process, it's really Congress that steps in and has its own dispute resolution process for counting electoral votes. And it's the new Congress that does that. And therefore, the rules governing how congressional seats and disputes over those are resolved could have an impact on the composition of that new Congress that's involved in making those decisions. And finally, we also looked at rules regarding vacancies and regarding recounts, because, of course, both of those sorts of authorities often come up when you're dealing with unexpected results and potentially a lack of results arising out of elections.
So that's how you decided which states to look at. And as a result of that, what were the states that were on your list?
Sure. Well, we ended up using the September 29th Cook's Political Report. That's the most recent one before we hit publish about how they allocated the states. And it basically identified 8 lean Democratic states: Arizona, Michigan, Minnesota, Nebraska. Although I should note, it's not the whole state in Nebraska. It's just the second congressional district. Nebraska is one of 2 states that allocates electors for each congressional district as opposed to on a statewide basis. In addition to Nebraska, Nevada, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, those were all considered lean Democratic states as of September 29th. The toss-up states were Florida, Georgia, Iowa, Maine, but again, only Maine's second congressional district, on the same logic as that I just explained regarding Nebraska, North Carolina, and Ohio. And then the only lean Republican state in the sort of universe was Texas. A few of the other states actually had been identified as lean Republican when we first started looking at the state laws, but ended up getting moved into the toss-up category. And so that's where they ended up around the time we hit publish. This category and this kind of universe of states may change, of course, as we get closer to the election, but it's remained relatively static for the last few weeks/months. I believe Nevada kind of came into this universe of lean states. But other than that, it's really been the 14 states that I listed that have been kind of moving back and forth between these categories.
All right. And so before we get into the details of any of the individual states, you know, I think people who were above a certain age and have a memory of the Florida 2000 controversy have a basic understanding that may be influenced by Florida law, or at least Florida law in 2000, that, hey, if things are really close, state laws will provide for a kind of automatic recount. And then once the result is certified by, in Florida's case, the Secretary of State, the losing party can challenge the results of the election. And my question is that just Florida law, or is that kind of a template under which a lot of states are operating?
A lot of states operate under a similar sort of rubric, but not all of them. And really, the approaches run the full gamut from a variety of different approaches states could take. Some states adopt an approach where they really don't, they seem to clearly account for the possibility of there being a challenge to elections issues, but it really kind of treats it like more conventional civil litigation. Michigan, I believe, fits in this category, where it anticipates it. It's in the code that you could have a legal challenge. They even, in the case of their congressional races, have special rules for preserving electoral evidence in the event of a dispute, although not in the presidential case, notably. But it doesn't really put out any special rules for how they're going to deal with those electoral disputes. A number of other states install something that looks a lot like more administrative processes, or in other cases, expedited judicial processes that consider at least certain types of claims and challenges through a different set of rules than you would see for conventional elections. And then a number of states actually specifically avoid adopting any sort of rules. New Hampshire is in this case. Maine is in this case. Nevada does so for congressional elections, but not for presidential elections. They actually do have rules for presidential elections. And they essentially, in all these cases, seem to be have made the statewide decision to more or less defer to the federal system for resolving electoral disputes. They don't take advantage of this initial deferral back to the states that's in federal law that I discussed in regards to the Electoral Counts Act. That said, each of those states does have procedures in place for recounts. So there's almost always a recount procedure. Sometimes it's automatic. Sometimes it requires an initiation by either an elector, meaning a voter in the state, or by an actual candidate in the race. It varies state to state. But almost every state has some recount procedure. But whether they have additional dispute procedures does vary a lot state by state, and the way they look varies a lot.
All right. So let's talk about some of the polar cases. You know, you sort of sketched out what the range looks like, but bring it down to brass tacks in states in which you could imagine an electoral dispute. You know, in his big article in the Atlantic, Bart Gellman, you know, basically describes, you know, state legislators in perhaps Pennsylvania rushing to appoint their own slate of electors, which is, of course, a prospect that came up in Florida in 2002. So let's start with Pennsylvania. Presumably, that would not be the first thing that happened. If there were a particularly close election in Pennsylvania, what do we know under Pennsylvania law about how it would play out?
Well, Pennsylvania is one of the states that actually does have a pretty well spelled out process for launching various types of electoral challenges. It actually divides their sort of different elections that might be challenges into a series of classes. And so, presidential elector and Senate elections are considered class two, because they're statewide is how that's kind of segregated out. House elections are put in a separate category, class four, and it kind of prescribes specific procedures about how these disputes are going to be resolved within a specific time frame. In the case of at least class two elections, meaning presidential elections, you know, you have to have a petition for a challenge kind of filed by a registered voter who voted in the election within a certain time period, I believe 20 days after the election, and has to be supported by a number of affidavits regarding the illegality or issues with the election that may have affected the return. So it's got these sort of rules in place that govern this result before anything would kick it out to a state legislature. There's no automatic kick to the legislature to start assigning electoral votes. There actually is in one other state, North Carolina, which we can talk about in a minute. So the question then with the Pennsylvania case becomes, well, you know, is there a grounds on which they could try and say, well, if the election's still disputed, we, the state legislature, still has the constitutional authority to determine how electoral votes are allocated. And the truth is, it's a kind of a tricky question. This drifts a little bit back more into federal law here as well. There is a federal law provision, 3 U.S. Code Section 2, that basically says if a state holds an election and then the results of the electoral votes aren't determined on election day, then the state can determine a later date in line with state law. This provision, it seems pretty clear, was designed to give states some flexibility in how they structure their elections. It really wasn't intended to sort of let the legislature step in and assert its own rules regarding how it could actually install electors. And the safe harbor provision that we mentioned before in the Electoral Counts Act, that's 3 U.S. Code Section 5, says essentially that for a state law to be treated as the presumptive resolution of a conflict by Congress, it has to be resolved in line with rules that are adopted on Election Day and that are in place and reach a resolution 6 days before the day that under federal law electoral votes have to be counted, which this year is December 14th. That really raises a question to say, well, can a legislature then step in later and start amending its state laws after the election results to reach some sort of conclusion? There is some tension there, certainly with the safe harbor provision, which again expressly requires that rules be adopted before Election Day to be relied upon and for those resolutions to be then binding on Congress in its own debates about electoral disputes. Although, again, we should get back to those and how binding they are. On top of that, there's also this question of constitutional rights. Certainly, Bush v. Gore has language, and other case law and ideas have language that once a state makes the decision to vest the allocation of its electors in an election and people vote in reliance on the election, it raises a question as to whether there's a constitutional entitlement there, meaning there may have to be due process requirements and other constitutional questions that will be raised if a legislature then comes in and says, well, we don't like the election results, we don't trust the election results, we're going to kick them out of our system. But that's the sort of argument that we're hearing from places like the Gelman piece, this sort of concern. And it is a possibility. You can see a legal argument there, but it also is not something that's currently in law in any of these states, again, except for North Carolina, which we should talk about. And it would require them to kind of go back on the existing law, which is really what federal law looks to, the law that's in place prior to Election Day.
And to be clear, the law, the default law is a specified recount and challenge procedure. Is that fair?
Correct. Yeah, it's kind of separate. A recount, a challenge can be something other than a recount in certain cases. Some states kind of lump them together. Pennsylvania, I believe, if I recall correctly, actually has a separate recount procedure that can exist separate from a contest, although a contest can also lead to a recount, obviously. So it has these sets of procedures, but that appears to be what's in place to take advantage of the safe harbor provision provided by the Electoral Counts Act, not some other rule that the state legislature may provide to allocate electors. They would have to do that on their own claim of presumably constitutional authority, or looking back to this 3 USC 2 law that says, well, if you know you don't appoint your electors on Election Day, the state legislature can step in. Although, again, I think the legislative history and the most sound reading of that is something closer to allowing states flexibility for conducting their elections, not allowing them to nullify the results of those elections in favor of a different preferred outcome.
You've mentioned North Carolina a couple times as though it were the state that had the most plausible prospective contemplation of the involvement of the legislature. How does North Carolina law work here? And how aggressive can we reasonably expect the North Carolina legislature to be?
So the North Carolina legislature, interestingly, after the 2000 presidential election dispute that ultimately led to President Bush being inaugurated in 2001, adopted a set of laws that essentially says, well, up until 6 days before the counting of electors, and meaning up until the end of that safe harbor window, or up until the date when we have to take advantage of that safe harbor window, we're going to have state law procedures that allow for different type of contest and allow people to kind of resolve different sorts of disputes. And they do have those sorts of procedures on the books about how to protest different types of election by any eligible voter or candidate, as I recall. But what it says is that if by the date when the safe harbor ends, that hasn't been resolved, it actually expressly kicks the determination of electors to the General Assembly, the state legislature of North Carolina, who's then supposed to reach some resolution about how to allocate the electors. And then it says, essentially, if by the day before, I believe, the electoral votes are supposed to be counted, you don't see the electors actually resolved by the General Assembly, then it becomes the governor's job to allocate the electors. In both of those cases, the law says the General Assembly and the governor are supposed to be allocating electors on the basis of their best judgment of what the electorate wanted. It's not giving them carte blanche to simply vacate the election results and then go and impose their own will. But it is a set of rules that exists prior to Election Day that gives those institutions a more central role in allocating electors in ways that might not exactly track with the election results, at least by some people see them if there is in the event of a dispute. And because they are kind of already in place before Election Day, there may be a little bit more validity or more defensible from the perspective of fitting within the safe harbor, and even from a constitutional perspective. You know, in Bush v. Gore, the Supreme Court said that actually individuals don't have any entitlement to vote individually for a presidential candidate until the state legislature gives it to them. In this case, North Carolina has given it to them, but has done so contingent on these other dispute resolution procedures going to the General Assembly and to the governor. So you could see maybe an argument having more sway there to say, well, these rules are a little bit in advance. Other states that haven't done that, though, they do have to overcome those questions, not only of the safe harbor requirements, but also of potential constitutional questions about the ability to take away the right to vote for president once it's been given to the population of their states.
All right. So both North Carolina and Pennsylvania have Republican legislatures, if memory serves, and Democratic governors. So my initial instinct says, okay, so theoretically, a Republican legislature could step in and appoint a set of electors, but in practice, a governor could veto that. However, the constitutional delegation in Article 2 is in a manner that the state legislature shall direct, suggesting that the governor may not have a role in these questions. And so my question is, is this a situation in which Democrats can rely on and Republicans should feel stymied by the possibility of a gubernatorial veto of an effort to appoint electors? Or is this a situation in which the legislatures could reasonably act on their own, irrespective of gubernatorial actions?
That's a really good question, and it's one of the challenging constitutional questions that's still hanging over this process. And it came up in actually in Bush v. Gore. Bush v. Gore, you saw an argument being made by some members of the court that essentially says that the Constitution privileges state legislatures in these sorts of circumstances so that they have a primacy to their values. And in the Florida dispute in 2000, it was, well, can the state Supreme Court supersede the will of the legislature by directing a recount procedure that's going to take it out of this safe harbor provisions timeframe and essentially supersede, at least in some views, some members of the court's view, the desire of the legislature to take advantage of the safe harbor provision and abiding by that sort of dispute resolution process that it had set out. A dissent from that, I believe it was Justice Stevens, although I'm doing this from the top of my head, so I may be misremembering, said, well, look, it's absurd to say that we are going to look to this and think that when the Constitution refers to the state legislature of a state, that it is, in fact, giving some extra constitutional authority to that state legislature. Instead, when it refers to a state legislature, it's referring to it in the context of that state's constitution, because that's what defines the authority of a state legislature. They don't exist independent of that. It's hard to judge their authority independent of a state constitution, and says that for that reason, if the state constitution provides for state Supreme Court judicial review or other procedures or a gubernatorial veto, as most, if not all, state constitutions do, then you are going to be in a case where you should be abiding by that. And because the state legislature doesn't have any ability to act separate from the state constitution. I think most commentators find the latter view persuasive, and even the people advocating the former view, you know, they were not essentially trying to completely supersede state constitutional rule. They were talking about the intent to take advantage of this one particular window. But it's a, you know, a problematic aspect of that decision that I still think hangs over a lot of the debates that are happening today.
So in other words, in both North Carolina and Pennsylvania, you have specified recount procedures, specified challenge procedures, and in different ways, the possibility of legislative intervention, in one case, probably within the safe harbor rule, in the other case, clearly not, but in both cases of which there would be some question as to whether the governor could veto the appointment of a slate of electors by the legislature.
I think that's basically right. But the degree to which that last question is really in question, how much can the state legislature act independent fully of the usual allocation of authority under the state constitution? I'm not sure. I think it's hard to know exactly how much weight that argument should be given. But it does seem like a possibility, at least, that one that's likely to be raised, may be raised, I should say.
All right, so let's talk about some other states. You mentioned some states that have very little in the way of specified procedures. What are some of those states, and what would happen if there were a contested result in those states?
Well, in the case, I think a good example of this is Maine. Maine actually, as I recall, had state legislative provisions addressing election disputes that it ended up revoking in the early 90s, and instead doesn't really provide any express procedure for how you deal with disputed presidential elections or congressional elections. And the implicit preference there appears to be that really it is essentially deferring to the federal procedures that are in place for how you would resolve electoral disputes for both sets of institutions. Although, again, I think it's worth noting Maine state law does have a procedure for recounts in place, but just not for broader sets of challenges. For presidential electors, what would happen if a state didn't take advantage of the safe harbor provision, or if it, like Maine, didn't have any procedures in place that were effective? Essentially, the question then goes to the resolution by a joint session of Congress that is called to hear the reading of the electoral votes. And federal law essentially says the president of the Senate, who is Vice President Mike Pence, opens all of the electoral votes provided to him, reads them out to the body. And then if people raise objection, a member of the Senate and the member of House jointly can raise an objection, articulate it, and then the two chambers go off to decide how they're going to resolve this election. Normally, there's a pretty convoluted voting process that comes into play that says, essentially, if the state has taken advantage of the safe harbor provision, then usually that safe harbor rule controls. If they don't, then usually the two chambers have to agree jointly that the about how to resolve a given dispute. And then if that is unsuccessful, generally the results that are endorsed by the state governor are given preference. But there's an open question as to whether those sorts of rules are necessarily binding. This is more of an academic argument, but I think it's floating about there because those are rules of procedure. And really, each Congress is empowered to enact its own rules of procedure. So in other statutory contexts where we've seen a prior Congress enact a set of statutory rules for how congressional procedures are managed, we've seen Congresses suggest that, in fact, they may not be constitutional for them to do so. In fact, they're going to adopt their own rules of procedure. Here, there's the added complication of this being a special session of kind of joint of the two chambers together. So how do you establish the rules for that session? Thus far, it's been managed by tradition, by past practices, and through a degree of contentious but ultimately accommodation between the two chambers. But, you know, there is the potential that those sorts of safeguards might kind of fall apart a little bit. I don't think that means that this law doesn't have any force. I think it's obviously the rules that people accept as kind of governing these things, at least in the first instance, but it doesn't mean there's not room to kind of for people to question that a little bit. It's worth noting for legislative races, for Senate and House races, each individual chamber actually plays a much more central role constitutionally in determining how people are allocated, or how seats, pardon me, in those chambers are allocated in the event of election dispute. They get to kind of set their own rules for their membership, have their own dispute resolution procedures. The House is partially statutory.
Because they can seat people or not, right?
Exactly. Decide whether to seat people. And then sometimes they will seat people even while a dispute is ongoing, and then ultimately replace them if essentially they decide, well, the election dispute has been resolved a different way. That's more on the House side. There's kind of a partially statutory process for resolving this, although there have been cases where the House has kind of adopted ad hoc procedures for resolving certain disputes. The Senate has its own rules-based system for addressing that that's not embedded in statute. But those would be the defaults for congressional races. And constitutionally, it kind of makes sense. Again, the Constitution says that the allocation of presidential electors is done by the state legislature in the first instance, although they're then counted by this joint session of Congress. But it says that each individual chamber can decide on its own members and who to seat. And so it makes sense a little bit that the Congress might play a more central role in resolving those congressional disputes. So you do see some states, Nevada being the prime example in the case of the ones that we surveyed, where they actually do have procedures for resolving presidential electoral disputes, but don't have as involved procedures for resolving congressional electoral disputes because they are going to go to these sorts of procedures. Although in Nevada, it's worth noting, as I mentioned before, it does have this kind of special procedure for preserving kind of election evidence, as I recall.
We've talked about two of the three states on which the 2016 election turned, which is to say, we've talked about Pennsylvania, But there are two others. One is Michigan and the other is Wisconsin, both of which are expected to be relatively close. So we've talked about what would happen in Pennsylvania. What do we know about the other two upper Midwest likely flashpoints?
Sure. Well, Michigan, I'm actually glad you mentioned this. Give me a chance to correct myself. Michigan, as I mentioned before, actually has a process where it really seems to view contested elections through the lens of more conventional civil litigation. There are state law provisions that clearly anticipate challenges happening, but they don't really spell out as specific a legislative, administrative, or adjudicatory process for doing it outside of more conventional litigation. Michigan, actually, and as I correct myself, not Maine, is the state that does have special procedures for preserving evidence regarding election disputes in the event that there is some sort of contest over House and Senate elections. You can essentially go to the Michigan Supreme Court and say, we think there is a reason to think this evidence may be tampered with. We need to essentially take extra steps to protect and preserve that evidence. There's no comparable set of rules for presidential elections for whatever reason, but they do exist there for House and Senate elections. And it anticipates that it's doing so in the event both of maybe state proceedings regarding that sort of election, but also in the event of there being congressional proceedings using the congressional procedures that are going to help preserve that evidence and in case they need it or somebody in the state feels like they might need it. So that is kind of how Michigan approaches it. More conventional litigation. There are rules in place for recounts as well. I don't believe that they're automatic, as I recall, but a certain threshold of making recounts available in the event of Michigan. Wisconsin is another one of those states like Maine that really does not have any specific procedures in place for resolving presidential congressional election disputes at the state level. Instead, it really does buck the question up. First to its own recount procedure, which again, it does have in place where it allows people who feel that the margin is within a certain range and have reason to request a recount. But it does not have any specific procedures for election disputes outside of that. So in effect, it is kind of, other than those recount procedures, deferring to the federal dispute resolution procedures.
So it's fair to say that if the election turns on Florida or Michigan, and it's close enough to warrant a challenge or support a challenge, you're going to see a pretty conventional piece of civil litigation, albeit a very high stakes one. If it is Michigan or Maine, you're going to have it essentially resolved through a combination of whatever recount happens and then congressional process. And if it happens in Pennsylvania or North Carolina, you'll have some kind of hybrid where there'll be elements of litigation, elements of recount, and sort of following very specified state legislative procedures. Is that fair?
I think that's generally fair from our reading of the state laws. And I do think it's worth noting as a caveat that, you know, I'm not necessarily an expert in these state laws, which are fairly complicated, although I spend a fair amount of time trying to understand them, and nor the students who kind of co-authored this piece with me and really did the legwork of digging through a lot of them. But from our best ability to understand it, I think that's a fair kind of summary statement, with the understanding, though, that litigators are creative, and that, of course, all of these procedures are happening against a backdrop of both state constitutional law and federal constitutional law, where there may be claims that might be novel, have another legal basis that's outside of the specific election code, that they may still be able to bring up and have legs in these processes. But in terms of what the state legislatures have anticipated and laid out in their law, I think that's a rough estimate of what it seems likely. But again, you know, we don't know where we're going to see a dispute. We don't know the exact nature of that dispute. I think the biggest takeaway you can get from this sort of survey is that state rules regarding these sorts of practices are variable, complicated, diverse, and therefore there's a lot of different directions it can go in under state law before we even get to the also complicated and sometimes difficult to parse federal procedures for resolving these elections.
All right. And now with that as a perfect setup, let's talk for a minute about those federal procedures. So I think you are clearly right that this is the first line of defense on this. People always talk about, you know, well, what's Amy Coney Barrett going to do? But it's not going to start in the U.S. Supreme Court. It got to the U.S. Supreme Court in 2000 through a convoluted set of state law litigations that were appealed from the Florida Supreme Court to the federal Supreme Court. It's not going to start in U.S. courts here either. It's going to start under some state law claims. And eventually, it is as likely or more likely that the dispute resolution mechanism will be congressional as it is that the dispute resolution mechanism will be federal litigation at the Supreme Court. So what do we know about the federal law overlay under which all of these statutes operate?
So the federal law in this area, again, feeds into the state procedures at that safe harbor provision. I think that's a good place to start. We will see the state resolution of any sort of dispute that qualify for that safe harbor provision provide a presumption about how it will be resolved by Congress in that joint session that I mentioned earlier. So you see both chambers get together. There's a means by which they open the electoral votes. A senator and a representative together can challenge the particular admissibility of electoral vote. They then separate and try and reach a common resolution. There's a bias in favor or presumption in favor of any sort of state resolution that might have fit within the safe harbor provision. Otherwise, the two chambers try and reach a kind of common resolution regarding which should be admissible or not. And then there's kind of a presumption in favor, as I recall, of whatever set of results is certified by the governor. So once you get to the point where you have the electoral votes kind of assembled and ready to count, you then go to determine whether any candidate has secured a majority of those votes. And there's a little bit of ambiguity here regarding whether it has to be a majority of all the electoral votes. That would be 270 of the 538 electoral votes allocated to all 50 states and the District of Columbia, or whether it has to be a majority of those appointed. The resolution of no election has ever hinged on this. There's been a little bit of variability in terms of how the requirement has been framed by different presidents of the Senate and different figures within the Congress. And there's kind of a little bit of an open question, which is the applicable standard there. That could, in a very close race, or in the event that there were a lot of electoral votes that were not allocated, that could become an issue, I think, in theory. But in practice, it has never resolved an election previously. If there is no candidate acquires a majority of those electoral votes, the process then goes to the process of a contingent election. And this is a process that I think has gotten a fair amount of media attention. People may be a little more familiar with. This is where the House of Representatives gets together and votes by state delegations among the three presidential candidates who got the most electoral votes and tries and reach a decision where one of them has to get a majority of state votes to, again, by state delegations, a majority of state votes to determine who is the president. And this is the kind of the process we think about notoriously with Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr election, with Alexander Hamilton playing this kind of central role that has become kind of notorious and part of American lore. Again, this process does kind of set out a procedures by which you are supposed to be able to resolve reaching at a president determining who it might be. There's a similar procedure in the Senate where the Senate has to decide the vice president among those who win a majority of the two candidates who win a majority of electoral votes for vice president. And this is kind of the end of the line for constitutional procedures. It does say if there is a vice president that is in line at the point where the current president's term ends, which is in January 2021, in this case, a kind of fixed date where it's very clear the president's and the vice president's term ends. If there's a new vice president who's been determined, but the president is still in dispute, then the vice president becomes president. After that, there's a kind of open question. There is a Presidential Succession Act. I think most people would think would apply here, but there is a little bit of a question as to whether the Presidential Succession Act, as I understand it, is intended to apply in these circumstances. But I think the more consensus view is that it is. And that law essentially says, well, if the vice president can't do it, then it is supposed to go to the Speaker of the House of Representatives, who in this case would be the newly elected Speaker of the House of Representatives for the new Congress. If not for them, it goes to President pro tempore of the Senate. And if not for them, it then goes to this chain of executive branch officials who would become the president in all these cases temporarily until the actual president was confirmed or otherwise became sort of eligible. the challenge here, and this is something that Jack Goldsmith has articulated in another article, is that there may again be a constitutional question as to whether a House of Representatives, Speaker of the House of Representatives, the President pro tempore of the Senate, as legislative officials can actually be within the kind of chain of command or line of succession for the presidency. Some people who believe in a strong vision of the separation of powers and the executive branch don't think legislative officers should fit in that chain. I don't know how if we have a strong sense of how likely that argument is to prevail, but it is a view that some people have articulated. And therefore, Jack has argued that there's a reason to think that you might end up with this disputed circumstance where an attorney general Barr, for example, could say, well, I don't think that legislative officials fit within this chain of command, and therefore Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who I believe is the first in that line of executive branch officials, actually becomes president, not Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, assuming she is reelected as Speaker of the House. Down there, the last point of resolution among those executive branch officials is that any of them have to be eligible for the presidency to fill that role. And the Presidential Succession Act actually says that they can't have been impeached by the House of Representatives. They don't have to be removed by the Senate, but they can't have been impeached by the House of Representatives. So it gives the House of Representatives a last point of leverage where, in theory, by impeaching some of these officials, and it's worth noting at this point, these executive branch officials would be the carryover from the prior presidential administration because they haven't been replaced by a new presidential administration, presumably, and their terms don't automatically end, that those people would then, if they were impeached, would become ineligible. And so it gives the House of Representatives a final point of leverage in determining who in that chain is actually eligible, assuming they do have valid grounds for impeachment. But ultimately, it then comes down to, well, which of these, in this case, Trump administration officials, is the House willing to accept by not impeaching them as the filling that kind of presidential role? And as far as I can tell, that's kind of as far down the chain as this process goes. Although, there are, of course, other nuances and angles that other people who have kind of fleshed out and other contingencies that might be out there.
So one last question. After doing this survey and looking at all these various state procedures, did you emerge more nervous about the possibility of a very close election, or reassured that we have the legal infrastructure to handle whatever the combination of COVID and Donald Trump's personality throws at us electorally?
I don't know if I came out feeling better or worse. As a lawyer, I take comfort in procedures. I like to see rules spelled out about how you go about resolving a dispute. And I do think that the existing rule set, particularly at the state level, does provide a set of avenues, but where, as we did see eventually in 2000, although it was a controversial outcome, you arrive at some sort of outcome. And the controversy, as in that case, might be where the legal limits of that state procedure versus federal procedure or constitutional requirements might be. But you do see these dispute resolution procedures in place. What I'm really struck by, though, is the diversity both at the state level and the number of questions that still exist throughout this system that, while there is a kind of prevailing, perhaps, understanding or norm or belief in how the practice should work, there isn't necessarily an absolute concrete answer. And so it creates lots of different points where you could see people who want to stir up chaos or raise controversy or really are willing to press their point in spite of norms and practices and perhaps the best interests of the country might have the opportunity to do so. And I do find that really concerning. And it's one of the reasons why, in the event of a really close election, we'll have to keep a close eye on how state procedures work as kind of the first line of defense, and then how these other procedures follow up to ensure that they provide a means of resolving this short of a constitutional crisis, a circumstance where there are no procedures left, and we're kind of at the end of the rope for deciding how our way forward as a country. In my mind, that's the most alarming circumstance.
Scott Anderson, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is the redoubtable Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo, who spent it fighting off birds and construction equipment, a power saw in one hand, a hawk in the other. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our merch is available at thelawfarestore.com, and you know you want to go there and buy our merch. Our promotional department is you. So go tweet about us and share us on whatever social media services you use. Rate and review us on whatever podcast distribution services you use. And by all means, talk to your friends about it. We spread by word of mouth. It's a kind of viral model. We're the virus. You're the carrier. Do your thing. Our music is, as ever, performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.